Greetings and good evening, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is Thursday, September 6, 2018. I've been thinking a lot about drinking water these days and water quality. Growing up in Cincinnati, I would see the Grand Ohio River, certainly on a daily basis. In those days, the Ohio River was in many ways just short of an open sewer. Industrial and agricultural chemicals were routinely dumped in the river, and most municipalities had inadequate wastewater treatment facilities. This was certainly true of the Cumberland River here in Middle Tennessee. Really scary to think that this was the source of our drinking water. With the passage of the Clean Water Act in 1972, the nation began the long process of improving water quality and preventing pollution of the water. Many billions of dollars have been spent on wastewater treatment facilities and in regulating industrial discharges into streams. The results have been positive for sure. We now see streams which are much cleaner, and we also see a rebounding aquatic wildlife, fish and birds that depend on these water courses. However, there remains a lot to be done. New causes of concern continue to arise, presenting new challenges. Among these are the presence of plastics and pharmaceutical chemicals in the water. And so my guest today is Dr. Matt Hurd, environmental science professor at Belmont University here in Nashville. Matt and his students are investigating water quality along the Cumberland River. What they are finding is certainly interesting and perhaps a little alarming. And so, I hope you'll enjoy my interview with Dr. Matt Hurd. So, Matt Hurd, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Matt, it's great to have you. I've known your family a little while, and now that you're back in town, it's really nice to see you.
Yeah, thanks. My mom speaks very highly of you.
You know, this program tends to focus on the natural environment, conservation, and those sorts of topics. And I know that's what you're into professionally.
Yes.
And I want to introduce you to my audience a little bit, but at the same time, talk to us about how you got into that and what was your motivation, what was your inspiration to get into the environment and ecology sort of work.
Sure, I'm happy to do that. It's a bit of a long story, but I'll give you the short version of it. I grew up in Nashville, and my mom, who you know well, is a big-time gardener. Right. And like all kids, I shunned wanting to do what my mom did, and I tried to not do that. But her influence on me and my parents' influence on me in general was really great because we spent a lot of time outside, and we went to all the parks around here, and I spent a lot of the time as a kid just picking up rocks and exploring. And I never made the connection that that was what I wanted to do until much, much later. But after I graduated from high school, I went to an outdoor education program called the National Outdoor Leadership School.
Knowles.
And it was, Knowles. And it was an awesome place because we got to go to these amazing spots in the southwestern U.S. and we learned skills like how to canoe and kayak and to cave and to rescue people. But at the same time, we were living outside, and it really got me excited. And so when I went to undergraduate at the University of Tennessee, I started to explore environmental studies and ecology as a major. And that's kind of where things jumped off for me. And I ended up working in a bunch of research labs and kind of getting an understanding of what scientists do. And then I parlayed that into going to graduate school, and I went to Brown University, where I got my PhD in ecology and evolutionary biology. And I won't bore us too much with the details, but the gist of it was I got to start doing science, and that was awesome, and I started to figure out how humans impact the environment.
So your undergraduate work was in what, field biology or something like
it
that?
It was in ecology and also in environmental studies. So I worked on invasive species. So in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park was where I worked.
That's the topic near and dear to my heart.
Yes.
You were working in the Smokies.
I was, yeah. So the hemlock.
The hemlock
woolly adelgid was the one I was working on.
Yep. Well, we could make a whole program talking about that. It's funny that you mentioned Knowles. Back in I guess it was like 1980, I had the privilege of meeting Paul Petzold.
Yeah, Paul Petzold.
Who was, you know, a notorious, actually very famous mountain climber
he
and
was.
Expeditionary guy, and was one of the founders of that mm-hmm. organization. So, and I should tell my audience that if you're interested, Matt's mother, Gail, was a guest on this show,
she was one
of our very first guests. Her name is Gail Eichelberger, and she's really one of Middle Tennessee's foremost experts on native plants and gardening and that sort of stuff.
She is. She's probably the smartest self-taught botanist I've ever met. She knows more plant species than just about anybody.
Yeah, she's pretty good with the Latin nomenclature.
She is.
I can tell you, I've never really attained that sort of thing.
It's not for everybody, but she loves it.
So, Matt, you are now on the faculty at Belmont.
Yes.
And for my listeners who are out of town, out of Nashville, Middle Tennessee. Belmont is was a small college that has become a very big university.
That's true. It's transitioned a lot.
10,000 students now?
About 15 years ago, it used to be 2,000 students, okay. And now we're at 8,300.
Okay.
Going up towards about 9,000.
Right. So with the law school and all kinds of stuff. So you're teaching ecology and environmental studies.
And mostly I'm teaching the environmental science program, and I teach some biology classes as well.
All right. So we got you here today, and you and I talked about a month ago at lunch and what might be an interesting topic, and water quality is something that you're working on particularly now.
Yeah, I spent about the last 6 years of my career working on water quality.
And, you know, there's been a lot in the papers recently about water quality, but I want to kind of go back to the mid-60s when the Clean Water Act was first passed. And the conditions of water at that time.
So one of the things that people don't know, because you hear about water quality in the news and you think things are really terrible and you hear stories about Flint, Michigan, and those are terrible, but it turns out that in the United States and much of the world, our water was pretty awful until about 1970. And the reason for that, at least the central reason for that, is because we linked our sewage systems and our drinking water systems. And that's because we have only a few places where you can get enough water to support a city. And so we would link all those pipes up together, and we had issues of where we would deal with waste, where we would put our water when we were done with it. And so those two systems, right, the sink that comes into your home and the toilet that goes out, were linked to a certain degree. And we often dumped a lot of our wastewater from our businesses and from our homes into the rivers that we drank out of. And this was a pretty huge problem. It's pretty nasty if you think about it.
You know, I used to hear back in the days when I worked in municipal government, I used to hear engineers talk about this problem, the combined sewer system. So you had septic sewer comes out of your bathroom and the storm water that came out of your gutters going into the same place. And it would overtax the municipal wastewater treatment people, but they said that the solution to pollution was dilution.
Yes, that's been the mantra forever. And in fact, ironically, that's still a mantra for the most part.
Okay, so we've come from not having rivers that are catching on fire, which happened in Ohio back in the day. To a place where we've really invested a lot of money in.
Our infrastructure has dramatically improved, and it's important to get. So I'm joking when I say that things were terrible in the 70s, but it was pretty bad when you dumped everything directly into your water source. It caused serious problems like the river fire in Ohio,
right.
But it also caused disease outbreak, and that was one of the biggest things. So the Potomac in D.C., the Cumberland River here, we had routine disease outbreaks that caused lots and lots of people to get sick.
Tell me more about that. I have not heard that.
So one of the biggest things that happens when you put human waste and chemical waste into an environment and then people can consume that water is that you can get infectious diseases that cause things like gastrointestinal illness. So you get sick, you can vomit, you get diarrhea. And those were very common after heavy rainfall events, after flooding events, and when people just came into contact with the river water itself.
Okay.
And the reason for that is because, just like every other animal out there, when you go to the bathroom, there's bacteria that are in your stomach, and those get passed on into your waste matter and then get put into the sewage system.
Okay. And even the finest municipal water treatment facilities can't get it all.
Well, so historically, we weren't doing much to filter that waste, and that was part of the challenge as well.
Okay.
And we've gotten better over time, so people started to realize that bacteria and viruses are very small in size, and there are things that will naturally kill them. So we were talking a little bit earlier that one of the ways people used to filter out water is through natural processes like sand and rock, and these kind of, they create a filter through those. But it turns out that that doesn't kill everything and that doesn't get rid of everything. So what we had to start doing was coming up with new treatments. And recently, we started to do things like add chemicals to the water, or we treat things with ultraviolet light. And that causes some of those things to improve. So since the Clean Water Act, we've gotten a lot better at treating our waste. And so we don't actually put out really dirty water anymore. And that's one very big thing that's different than it used to be.
You know, the Nashville and many big cities, I know Cincinnati is also, but Nashville is under a consent decree, even currently with the Environmental Protection Agency, for violations of discharge regulations. And this happens when we get a storm event, when we get a lot of water. What are they doing to address that situation?
Part of the thing that we're doing is, okay, so I'll explain this to kind of give a little simpler version of it. But every city has to deal with lots and lots of water coming in heavy rainfall events. And there's challenges for that. Where does that water go? And as a city builds up, there's more and more concrete. It's harder for this water to penetrate into the ground. And so it gets displaced. So think about it like a parking lot. That water rushes off somewhere and goes into a storm drain. Storm drains can get clogged up. Those storm drains can be problems. And this water itself then can eventually even backflow because of that combined sewer system into the wastewater treatment plants.
Okay.
It can be filled up with all kinds of things, and it becomes a really big issue. In Nashville, for example, we still have, when there's heavy rainfall events, and this is what you were talking about, the points where the wastewater treatment plants are at capacity. And when that happens, the water just flows directly back into the Cumberland.
Right.
And they cannot treat it if they hit a certain capacity level. This is what happened in the 2010 flood when this wastewater system treatments, when the wastewater treatment plants went offline. It happened last year pretty close to this when Hurricane Harvey hit in Texas and then came up through Nashville and we got about 10 inches of rain. We were right at capacity. And that water just has to then flow directly back out into the Cumberland, and that leads to major, major problems.
So Nashville is still dealing with problems with the infrastructure that were probably created in the 1890s.
Yes.
So you...
And to be honest with you, just about every major city in the U.S.
Sure.
still deals with this, and
sure.
you'll actually notice that in a lot of cities... you'll see signs by rivers where they actually say, don't swim in the rain. And it's because of this, and they have pipes where sewage still can flow out, or wastewater that's untreated can flow out into a river and
so
cause this problem.
People that live in Nashville will remember 4 or 5 years ago that Church Street, major thoroughfare in downtown Nashville, was dug up, for lack of a better expression, for about 18 months while they changed the sewer configuration so that they had one pipe for the storm water and another pipe for the septic sewer.
Yep.
The process of doing that throughout the entire city is really, really expensive.
I have a friend who works for Metro Water, and he is an assistant director of one of the plants. And I was talking to him about the infrastructure, and he said, if you think about it in the simplest way, the city takes about 30 years on average to completely overhaul the infrastructure for water.
Okay.
And that's for distributing it to your house and dealing with wastewater.
Okay.
You work your way from one side of the city to the other, or you deal with specific events as they come up, but generally you work your way across the city. He said you immediately turn around and that system is now outdated and you start it again.
Do they have in Nashville any kind of goal or any kind of timeline that they think that they're going to completely separate these systems?
I think each city's kind of dealing with that on their own. I don't know the specific plan for Nashville. I will say on their behalf, I do think Metro Water is pretty cognizant of this issue, mm-hmm. and they do an excellent job. We actually do have very good water quality here and good drinking water, and there's really no issues with anything that we have in the immediate Nashville area. We do have routine violations and concerns outside of the city,
right.
but generally Metro Water is pretty good about this. And even when there's been these big flood events, it's been pretty quick that they've been able to deal with any of the challenges.
So I think from a listener's standpoint, I think people need to be aware, you know, when Metro government is going through its budgeting process, the money that's spent on this brick and mortar kind of undertaking, it's not sexy.
No, but it's really important. And the thing that's a little bit hard to understand probably for people is that most everybody is pretty removed from what happens with how they get their water and where it goes when they flush their toilet or turn on the sink. And that's kind of an interesting process. There's been a reduction in the workforce. There's a massive, in terms of how many people are needed to run plants, so there's fewer experts.
Okay.
There is a loss of people working at Metro Water, and they actually are dealing with about a third of their labor force retiring within the next 5 years.
Wow.
And so there's this big thing. I take students out to wastewater treatment plants all the time, and the routine response I get from them is kind of what you said. This isn't sexy. I don't want to do this. But you laugh, and I laugh to them, and I say, you work in wastewater. You will always have a job because it never goes away.
Right. Well, it's fascinating stuff. And I want to skip ahead then
sure.
and talk about things, that sort of some of the things that we've seen in the news recently.
Yeah.
I noticed that we had a couple rivers in Upper East Tennessee closed for notices put up, don't eat the fish, the Nolichucky and the pigeon.
Yeah.
I believe there's mercury contamination up there. So we have new kind of topics in the contamination of water source.
We do. So part of the thing that happened with the Clean Water Act that was really beneficial was that we regulated the dumping of things like heavy metals. So mercury and other toxic sources, PCBs, which are another huge human health threat. And we regulated the dumping of those, but they stay in the environment for a really long time. And mercury doesn't just go away. And mostly what happens is this settles down into the sediment inside of a river or a lake. And so we have a lot of regulations, or at least advice, on not eating certain types of fish. So for example, catfish caught in the Cumberland. I would never recommend it, and no one else would too. But certain things have been pretty safe. When that sediment gets disturbed from storms over time or dredging that happens over time, or if there's any sort of new source of pollution, whether it's accidental or on purpose, that's where you get these fishing regulations that pop up. Sometimes we didn't even know it was there, and then we find out later, and then you have to create this regulation.
You know, the mercury, what I've read is mostly from fly ash from burning
yes.
of coal.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that is a huge byproduct, so every time any coal is consumed, there is a bit of mercury that's given off.
Goes into the air, then it gets in the water.
Yeah, and that is becoming an increasing source. We used to routinely dump mercury accidentally and on purpose, going back about 70 years, but that's a different thing. So now it is generally just a byproduct.
Well, and then the Clinch River, you know, TVA had a coal-burning generator facility there where they stored the fly ash from the coal over 20 years or more.
Yeah.
I mean, just a huge mountain of coal, and then it broke and got into the river.
Yeah, and this is one of the concerns, is this idea of leaching, and that you can have these sites where you think they're contained, but they're not actually contained. This is really, this is kind of that world of emerging threats that we talk about. So generally the story with water quality is that it's gotten better since the Clean Water Act, because it was really bad, and it is getting better, but there are some new threats that are coming along right now that people are scared of.
Well, tell us more about that.
So two of the biggest things that are emerging that people are really terrified of are plastics. So these so-called microplastics. Most of the attention for that's been in the ocean. But these microplastics are small bits of plastic that come off of fishing gear, that come off of bits of clothing, that come off of our waste. And they're being found in all of our waterways across the United States. They're being found in very large patches in the ocean, especially in the Pacific Ocean. And that's a very scary thing, because plastic is made up of chemicals that can have some serious health consequences for people. So things like endocrine disruptors. And then the other big one that we're seeing a lot of concern about is that we have personal care products, so things like pharmaceuticals that are getting in the water. And that's a concern, but there's also a concern about whether they can drive things like antibiotic resistance in bacteria. Gotcha. And other things that are emerging as well.
Gotcha. You know, plastics are not a new thing. I mean,
no.
We've had plastics since the 50s.
Yes.
Why is this just now emerging as a...
So there's a couple of reasons. Our use of plastic has dramatically increased over time.
Right.
And the other big thing is that we found better ways to test for it.
Okay. So tell us more about that. You told me a little bit about this when we had lunch.
Sure. A thing for people to get is that the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and local management agencies, city water agencies, they don't regulate everything because they don't have the money or the time to test for everything. And people generally thought for a really long period of time that if there was plastic in the water, you'd see it, right? Like a big bottle or a piece of plastic. And just running something through a filter would be enough. So what I mean when I say a filter is, imagine like the drain in your shower. It's catching it.
Right.
But what we're realizing is that these plastics are in really small pieces. They never degrade over time. They break down. And so we're starting to see, as we produce more and as more processes end up with plastic being used, like more distribution processes, more waste products, it gets into our water supply. It comes off of our clothing. Things like fleece jackets are made of plastic, and they have filaments that are small pieces that get into the water
supply. So if we wash my nylon underwear, it would...
Small bits of it can break off, into your washing machine's wastewater, and that goes out to a wastewater treatment plant. And they don't have the capability or time or resources to deal with that. So that gets into the water supply.
Into the Cumberland River.
Yes.
Right.
And this has kind of gotten a lot of attention because people are really concerned about the effects on biodiversity. There's a lot of really interesting studies that have been done where they show that birds are consuming mass quantities of this, whales are consuming quantities of this, and it kind of goes up the food chain. And just now people are starting to really think about, okay, well, if that's true for them, what about for humans? What kinds of effects are we going to have on human health?
So let's go back.
Sure.
I want to dig into all those things that you just mentioned are really important. Tell us about the evolution in the scientist's ability to test for such things as plastic in the water.
Sure. So plastic is a hydrocarbon-based material. And so that means it's made of oil, but also of other chemical derivatives. So it's got a lot of things that are in there together. And we used to use a technique, and people still do this very routinely, where they add an acid to it, so something that's very acidic, to a sample, where like a water sample or a collection, you know, whatever you would want to look at, or a bunch of dirt where you'd want to look for plastic, and they pour acid over this. And the reason they do that is because it breaks down all the organic material, so all the things like dirt and wood and whatever, and it leaves those chemically based products that are left. It's very labor intensive, it's very hard to do. And it's not a simple process. It takes about 8 hours to do a single sample. And so what they've realized is that there's some new technologies that are out there. So we can put things under a microscope and use different color lights that will show up, these plastics will show up under. We can inject certain types of dye into a water sample and it will light up the plastic, and you can again look at it under a microscope. So it's gotten a bit easier to do, and we can look at things in a much faster way than we used to be able to.
So you have students that that work with you in your program at Belmont.
Yes.
That are actively doing water sampling.
Yeah, so I've been working on water quality work, which is what we say, for a long time, for about 6 years. And we go out and we collect water samples and we call sediment samples, so bits of dirt, to see what we find in there. This past year, we did the first ever microplastic, so small bits of plastic study, where we looked at water in the Cumberland River to see if we found it.
Okay, now so you said a lot of things there. The first time that this has been done, and it's the Cumberland River. So
yes.
The Cumberland River is a long river. So
yes.
What was your technique?
So what we did was, we had a student, and her name was Lena Saeed, this year, and she went out and she collected water samples in Nashville.
Okay.
And she collected them in East Nashville and downtown Nashville and West Nashville.
Okay.
So at Shelby Bottoms Park, for those of you who are familiar with it, Shelby Bottoms at the downtown Riverfront Park, and then at Cleese's Ferry in West Nashville.
Okay. So she didn't go up into the upper reaches?
No, and the reason for that is because it was just for ease and for time.
Okay.
And given that no one had done any of this type of water sampling in Nashville, we thought this was a good place to check out.
Okay.
The other reason that she picked those spots are that Nashville gets its drinking water from the Cumberland River, and it also puts its wastewater into the Cumberland River. So what we thought was a good plan for looking at this was, could we go basically above stream, from what that means is kind of pre where we get our drinking water and pre where we put our wastewater, and then could we look at a couple points along the river where our wastewater goes back in to see if we're getting more plastic added to the water because of what we're putting into it? Does that make sense?
Yeah, what's coming into the city? Is there already plastic in it?
And then do we find more because of the things that people are doing?
And what have you been finding?
So it turns out that we found out that there is plastic that's in the water
even prior to it gets to Nashville.
There is plastic in every water sample that we collected. So there was not a single water sample where we didn't find a small bit of plastic in it.
Okay.
But we did find that it increased downstream. So people in Nashville are also contributing to this problem as well. Okay. And that's scary, you know.
Okay, so give us some dimension on this. I mean, is it a lot of plastic, a little plastic?
I'll say
a significant amount of plastic.
This is where the biggest challenge is right now in terms of this microplastic and plastic research. We have no official regulations of what amount of plastic is healthy and what is not.
Okay.
What are the sort of points where you'd have negative effects for people? And we have no real understanding across the United States of how much plastic is in our drinking water generally, so we don't know how we compare. We don't know how this changes over time. So what I'll tell you is, most people, when they go out and do a water sample, they collect about a liter of water, so a quarter of a gallon.
Okay.
And there are lots of places where people have found that usually there might be one or two pieces. We were finding about 15 to 40 different pieces of plastic in a liter sample.
Okay, measuring how many grams or micrograms?
So in terms of weight, it's so tiny because we're talking about things that are less than a pinhead in size.
Okay.
So you're really not getting much. It's not like you're eating a chunk of plastic when you drink water, but it's interesting because people didn't know they were consuming this in the first place.
Okay, and so consequences of this plastic. I guess it's speculative. Very speculative.
Yes.
Okay. So on humans, you mentioned the hormonal connection between
the endocrine system. Yeah. So the research on this is that plastic itself often has harmful chemicals that are mixed in with those oil compounds. So the reason that some plastics can't be recycled, for example, is that they have chemicals that are associated with it that are toxic to human health. So when they're processed, they might release something that could cause some negative consequences for people. Some of those things are endocrine disruptors, and some of them are other types of chemicals. Some of the endocrine disruptors that we know really well are BPA and phthalates. And BPA has gotten a lot of attention within the last 5 years because people realize that this can cause a hormone imbalance in large quantities. Mm-hmm. But this led to people with, especially with children's products, so like bottles that are made of plastic, to try and say that they no longer have BPA in them.
Okay.
Another one is phthalates.
And those show themselves in human helps with sort of abnormalities in sexual glands.
It does in mass levels, and most of the levels at which we were consuming these things as a byproduct of what we came into contact with, it was never at a point at which we were going to expect any health effects.
Okay.
But the concern with this is most studies are done, most scientific studies where they look at health effects of chemicals are done where they give you a large dose and then they look at to see if there's an effect. They don't do studies where they're just long-term low dosage exposures.
Gotcha.
And that's very concerning because that's reality. So if you were to get tested to see if you had ever been exposed to BPA, you would likely have been. Everybody here would have been.
Right.
And we don't know about those low dosages over time. And I don't say this to scare people, but more to understand, we're constantly exposed to things and we don't know their full extent of their effects.
Of course, the wildlife, the fish and birds that are out there in the environment that don't necessarily benefit from the treatment that we get in our homes for water.
Yeah.
They're drinking raw water.
They are.
And eating other organisms that have been digested.
Yeah, material. So the small bits of plastic go up the food chain. Okay. So like plankton and small microscopic level things get eaten by small fish and crustaceans, you know, snails, and then they get eaten by a bird. And those things go up the food chain. Birds are really particularly vulnerable to this with plastic. So they've actually been shown to eat large amounts of plastic and have serious consequences because they can't digest it. And so they don't pass it on. And so we actually often see, especially with ocean birds, that we find albatrosses and other birds where they have mass quantities of plastic in their stomachs that they can't process. And they just die from starvation because they can't pass it out.
Right. So we get notices that don't eat the fish in the rivers.
So usually, I will say none of that has been due to plastic yet. Okay. But here, that's almost all because of other things, heavy metals. Plastic's just the newest threat that people are really, really concerned about.
Okay.
The other thing that really gets people here that they don't know as much about, as I was saying, is those personal care products.
Oh, sure. Yes, we were going to talk about that.
And those we do see have a huge effect on wildlife. And it's kind of routinely been shown that fish and small organisms like frogs and amphibians, they can actually have sex changes and developmental changes because of things like hormones like estrogen that are put into the water.
These are actual pharmaceuticals that are
introduced,
flushed down the toilet or whatever. Obviously, when they're flushed, they're in a very strong
concentration.
Concentration, exactly.
This is where dilution is not the solution.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
I was going to follow up on that. But it's not just the endocrine type of pharmaceuticals, but it's also antidepressants and psychotropics and all kinds of things that are in the water.
We find now pretty much routinely in every water source, I mean, this is your local river, your local creek, your pond, your lake, we find opiates, we find psychotropic drugs, as you said, that are for dealing with depression. We find Zoloft, you know, which is a name brand version of an antidepressant drug. We find antibiotics of every major class. So every group of antibiotics that's out there we now find. And we actually now find bacteria and other things that are resistant to those antibiotics as well.
Have there been any good studies done about those pharmaceutical type chemicals in the water and the effects on humans?
Some. So almost every one of the chemicals that is in a drug that you might take has gone through rounds and rounds of testing through the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, to see if they have impacts. But again, the big challenge is they don't think about it in terms of these low dosage exposures over time. And the other thing is that the EPA, who is the primary regulator for water, they don't have the capacity to test and regulate for all of the different chemicals that we get from every drug that gets put into the water, from every pesticide that gets into the water. And so it just gets overwhelming.
Well, and then we have state government regulators folks that are supposed to be out there monitoring mm-hmm. the situation, and comment about their capacity to monitor.
The typical pattern for most states has been that the state regulatory agency, so in our case, the Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation, has usually got a limited budget to monitor water sources over time. And that budget has reduced. The number of people who can go out and test things are reduced. So what we do is we put water sources on a cycle, and we only measure them every couple of years. And we usually only measure them when we do that for a short period of time. And that's a problem because it means that you can have contamination and it might go undocumented. You can have contamination and it might be temporary. And we also don't necessarily know where that contamination is coming from because we don't know how it got there. We're not doing intensive studies on that.
So Matt, you have I'm sure a cadre of students that are working with you.
Yeah.
And so what's the future plans in terms of continuing with the monitoring that you're doing with water quality?
Yeah, so the biggest things we're working on right now are trying to establish some baseline information for Nashville. And we want to understand how much plastic pollution there is so we can at least understand how that changes over time and figure out if that's even a threat. We are also looking for the emergence of antibiotic-resistant bacteria in the river to see generally what types of antibiotics are here and whether that might pose a threat to people. And then the last thing that we're doing is we're trying to see if some of these pharmaceutical agents that are put into the water source are affecting other types of organisms like the algae and the animal species.
And how are you monitoring that?
We actually do experiments where we expose them to chemicals over time.
Okay.
Like I said, lots of studies have been done on human health, but you can imagine there's been limited work on how, say, an opiate might affect algae. And so you try, or a muscle. Right. And the southeastern U.S., I don't say this lightly because I care very much about human health, but from a biodiversity perspective, the southeastern United States is the freshwater diversity center of the world. We have some of the highest levels of fish diversity in the entire world. We're the epicenter of mussel diversity for the entire world. And that's really important that we keep that.
So do you have students that are actively going out and taking samples?
I do, yeah. We have four students working with me, and they are all working in the Cumberland River. But in the spring of this year, I'm starting a new research program where we're going to go out and we're going to do some of this work scaled up with 16 students. And I'm working with another professor, but we're going to start trying to get this out where we can really get a bigger sense of the entire watershed of the Cumberland and into the Harpeth. So this region is kind of the middle Tennessee Cumberland River Basin, mm-hmm. and we want to see across that whole area what kinds of levels of pollution we're getting, where it's coming from, and what the big threats are.
Are you working in cooperation with the municipal governments?
Or? I do a little bit, but I tend to try and give Metro Water a heads up about what some of the things are that I'm finding. I do want to make this clear. I think they're good people who are really trying to do good work, and I think they're underfunded in terms of what they can monitor.
Right.
And so I try and communicate my findings with them so A, they're not blindsided, and B, they kind of know what threats are coming.
Right.
I'm trying to work with some folks at other places as well, from Tennessee Aquarium and a few other spots, to create a freshwater working group where we can try and get a bunch of combined resources together. And there's lots and lots of other things to do. There's lots of amazing nonprofits that are working on these mm-hmm. things, but their primary goals are often about education and mm-hmm. land preservation, and so this is kind of much more in the research world.
So where does the money come from to do this sort of stuff?
It's a great question. Some of it is internally funded through the university, and the reason that we can rationalize for that is because we give students an experience of how science works.
Right.
You can apply for federal grants, but I can tell you that water quality work and state grants is often not funded. And the reason for that is because it falls into a gray area where you either have to decide, are you going to focus on human health or are you going to decide to focus on biodiversity mm-hmm. and impacts of the environment? And those two are related, but they tend to be funded by different types of places. And this kind of work just generally isn't well funded at all.
Well, that's a shame, because it's, I mean, water is the basis of life, of course.
And, yeah.
Having clean water, we take it for granted.
We do.
Really, here in the States.
We do. And we actually have great water in Nashville, like I said, but people don't know that, and they don't know what the concerns are about keeping it good as right. we move forward.
Right. So are there organizations in Nashville that are dealing with this that people need to follow, or if people were interested in your work and they wanted to follow your work, how would they do that?
So the first question about who to look to in the community, I would say there's two agencies, two nonprofits in town that I think are incredible. So the first is Cumberland River Compact.
Okay.
They have some of the most up-to-date information on where water quality is good and bad across the entire Cumberland River. That's the full 800 miles of it. They do excellent work to raise funds and awareness to try and do local cleanups. They have adopted stream and river programs. They're really great, and they're one of the best organizations. There's also the Harpeth River
Conservancy.
Yeah. And they are really important for this area because they are focused on the Harpeth River, which is the drinking water source for Franklin, which is just south of town.
Right.
And that's really important because they're dealing with a lot of threats of a massively growing population with a very small river that's a lot more constrained than what we have in the Cumberland.
Matt, I noticed recently reporting in the newspapers about the Harpeth River mm-hmm. and the removal of a couple of mill dams that had persisted along the river. That's an important thing to do.
It is, and we've basically put a lot of barriers for ourselves in waterways for animals that try and use these spaces, and we've just kind of routinely changed the way waterways worked. And there's a big movement to try and restore some of this, because if you get rid of a dam, it increases the amount of water flow that's in an area. It keeps things from being able to just be confined to one spot. And it can really help to improve the health of a stream.
Right. The fish can easily move up
yeah.
and back freely. And
One, it changes the oxygen content by letting a river flow. It helps with flooding issues when you don't have a dam. It's just kind of a win-win.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned oxygen content. One of the things that I learned when I first moved to Tennessee was about the effects of these large lakes that we have that are, you know, in bay by these great big dams.
Yeah.
And when you have water sitting still for that long, and as deep as it was,
yeah.
The water that comes out the bottom side has less oxygen in
yep.
it, to the detriment of all the...
It has less oxygen, it has a different pH, okay. it has a different temperature.
Okay.
And when you dump those out, like, so if you think about it, an example from here, if you're going out I-40 and you see the Stones River Dam, that water coming off the bottom there...
Percy Priest Dam.
Yeah, Percy yeah. Priest Dam. Yeah. It it's an interesting thing because it's a big change. Not only are you going from a lake to a river, but you're actually then going and changing this by taking water off the bottom. That's this sort of low oxygen, colder water that is just a different kind of
thing. Yeah, TVA over the years has changed their mechanisms and injected air and all that kind of stuff into the turbines.
And that's part of the things they do when they run it over those turbines. They do oxygenate some
right.
of it. But it still is a pretty
so
big change of pace.
So yeah. fascinating. Well, Matt, keep us informed about what you're up to. You're welcome back. And if you'd like to address my audience anytime.
Cool.
And I sure thank you for coming and
right.
visiting with me.
Well, thanks, Mark, for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. Let me get this off.